And good morning. It is just a few seconds before 9 a.m. and you are tuned. KBOO Portland. Coming up next on Political Perspectives, host Kathleen Stevenson welcomes Peter Neal of the World Ocean Observatory and author of The Once and Future Ocean, Notes Toward a New Hydraulic Society. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, news, views, and interviews with hosted by Chris Andre. At 10:15, on Flashpoints, today's show, we have more excerpts from the documentary film Capitalism. And then at 11 today, it's the Bike Show. They will welcome guests Kimball Taylor and Lorenz J. Finneson, who explore how bicycles carve their mark, from Tijuana immigrants to Boston movers and shakers. Thank you, KBOO members and listeners who make this radio station thrive. If you are not already a member, you can become one by visiting our website at kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today in the top right corner.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Setup, a play that takes place in Hell's Kitchen during the late 1920s. It focuses on a black boxer, an eminent champion, whose return to the ring is secretly set up for defeat. The Setup runs from February 12th through March 5th at the Shaking the Tree Theater, 823 Southeast Grant Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 26th annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 5th through March 5th. Most of the films will screen at Portland Community College Cascade Campus, and two films will show at the Hollywood Theater. The five-week-long festival of feature and documentary films come from all over the African continent and include Thursday evening documentary screenings, Family Film Day, and Women Filmmakers Week, held during the first week of March in celebration of Women's History Month. Again, that's 26th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, playing Thursday through Saturday until March 5th. Most of the films will screen at Portland Community College Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street, in the Arts and Humanities Building in Room 104. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Churches were built in the sea, and if three times one was nine, then the world would be upside down. Yes, the world would be upside down. What a topsy-turvy world this would be. World would be upside down.
Good morning. This is Political Perspectives. I'm Kathleen Stevenson, and I'm happy to welcome to KBOO Peter Neal. Peter, welcome. Thanks for coming in today.
Good morning, Kathleen. Great to be here.
And also with us is Casey Neal, who's escorting Peter Neal.
There is a vague relationship.
Okay. Great to have both of you. Peter Neal is founder and director of the World Ocean Observatory and author of the new book, The Once and Future Ocean, Notes Toward a New Hydraulic Society. Throughout his career, Peter Neal has contributed to organizations devoted to marine affairs, education, and culture. He has published several books, both nonfiction and fiction, and he produces the program, the podcast, World Ocean Radio. And in addition to being an author and editor for American Sea Writing, Peter Neal is also a regular contributor for a blog on the Huffington Post. And Peter Neal will be at the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference giving the opening keynote address tomorrow night, Thursday night.
Thursday night it is.
In Eugene.
I'm all fired up.
Good.
Terrified, actually.
Well, I'm glad we got you first.
Yeah.
So, Peter, for a minute, if you could tell us, you're the founder and director of the World Ocean Observatory. What is it, and what do you do there?
Well, the World Ocean Observatory is a web-based place of exchange about the ocean, defined as an integrated global social system. So it transcends the more conventional approach of an emphasis on species and habitat, and it looks at a way of connecting the ocean to climate, freshwater, food, energy, health, security, cultural traditions. So it takes the much larger, longer view of what the ocean is and how it doesn't separate us in this world, but actually it actually connects us. And so W2O, we call the World Ocean Observatory, it's a very clever little acronym, is online at worldoceanobservatory.org, and you can go there and find a body of information that I claim is as wide and deep and dynamic as the ocean itself. It's huge. And we've been putting this information together and aggregating it from all kinds of places for almost 10 years now. And everything on it is essentially packaged into communications tools. It's available to the public at no cost. The idea being that we advocate through the best and most responsible information, and we use the economies and of scale and cost of the internet to reach a literally global audience. So there, we have millions of visitors. We have World Ocean Radio. We have a World Ocean Journal, which is an online magazine. We have a forum. And we have all other kinds of ways through social media that we're literally talking to millions of people from a small room on the coast of Maine. Mm. It's really kind of remarkable. It's a miracle. I wake up every day and say, well, whose mind can I change today?
Great. And just personally, how did you get your interest in the state of the ocean and so interested in
Well, I was born in St. Louis, which is about as far away from the ocean as you can get in any direction. I never saw the ocean until I was 18 or 19. I'm terrified. I get seasick. But what you realize is that this thing, which we see as a place apart, we go to the beach and it seems to, it has this distant horizon, and maybe there might be a the waft of a smoke of a ship or something passing, but what's out there is essentially the system that connects us all through the distribution of goods and people and ideas and natural elements. And in those ways, there it represents a kind of massive engine of circle and cycle and conveyance that brings things together, does not separate us. And if there's ever a time for the need to bring things together, it's now. Mm-hmm. I argue that that's what globalization really is about. It's about essentially trying to understand that the world is now a very small place with an awful lot of people in it. And in order to live and survive in it effectively and successfully, we're going to have to understand it better and change the way we look at it.
And we're going to get into that. I want to talk to you first, if we can. I want to mention that we will take calls during this hour. So if you have a question or comment on this topic of the ocean and the future of a new hydraulic society, you can give us a call in a few minutes. Probably in about 10 minutes, we'll start taking calls. And the number is 503-231-8187. So why is the ocean, I read one line, the ocean is the world's most imperiled natural element.
Well, yes, it is. Let's start with the long view. If you look at Earth from space, it actually is a blue marble. It's 70% covered by water. Water, it's part and parcel of every aspect of life on Earth, including ourselves, obviously. And it's probably misnamed. We shouldn't call it Terra. We should call it Aqua. So we live in this ocean planet. That's the first thing. Now, as you come down into the world and you look at, say, beginning, let's say, with the Industrial Revolution, you see that we created a system, a paradigm for living that is has become a global phenomenon, which says that we are going to have essentially unlimited growth. in the name of consumption, driven by fossil fuels. That's been the paradigm that began in the 19th century and has evolved itself to this day. There have been benefits. There have been benefits. Let's not be silly about it. There have been many, many benefits. It's called people's living, their comforts, their education. Many, many things have derived from this. However, we've now gotten to the point where Terra is exhausted and the negatives overwhelm the positives. And the more everything is telling us this now, the old way is over. And we need to recognize that that paradigm is done for. And the market is telling us, the price of the barrel of oil is telling us, the pain that is now the world is going to go through as we understand that our reliance on a single revenue product which is finite and which is causing enormous amounts of damage to the earth can no longer be acceptable. It simply is no longer the way to live. So what's next? That's the big problem. You can read all these books that and mine included, has a, you know, that starts and says, well, what's going on? And it's apocalyptic. It's not good. Mm-hmm. But when you get to the last chapters and you turn the page, there's nothing there. What's next? What's the new idea? And so what I'm trying to do now is to say, well, the new paradigm, the new 21st century paradigm, is based on the most valuable thing on earth, which is water in all its forms and shapes, which is the water cycle that we all learn about in school. But I call that the ocean. The ocean begins at the mountaintop. It ends in the abyssal plain. It evaporates into the atmosphere, and it descends back down into the watersheds in this global cycle which affects us all. Without it, without 40 liters a day, we die. It's so simple. You know, you whether you're an individual, whether you're a family, whether you're a city, whether you're an institution, whether you're a nation state, if you do not have adequate water, you die. So we see it all around us. People are beginning to talk about it a lot. We fight water wars. You can look at the Middle East. You can see that's a water war. You can look at the Middle East and say that the whole refugee migration is an effect of water drought, lack of climate, political instability, looking for a new place to live and survive as a result. And people are talking about that. You have Flint, Michigan. My God, this terrible story of some small ideological cost-saving decision with no thoughtfulness whatsoever, some short-term political advantage or financial advantage, which destroys a community. That it's not going to, you know, it's not going to come back. What happens to those people who are living there? What happens to their families? What's happening to their children whose bodies are now affected by the corroded, you know, the lead in the system? What happens to their real estate values? How can they leave? They're prisoners. Mm-hmm. They've been made prisoners by a decision that goes all the way back to water. So I argue that then the new paradigm is going to be managed growth, because we're going to go from 7 to 9 billion people. So we have to manage it. We can't just have it unlimited. So we're going to have to manage it in the name of sustainability, because it's foolish not to exhaust it, not to create a system that allows for its renewal, and driven by this most valuable, precious thing called water.
So is that what you mean by we have been a land-based world, a land-based economy, a land-based everything, and we need to switch to a water-based?
Well, yes, because it's a matter of survival. You know, I mean, the land is not going to save us. We've poisoned it in the name of extending our reliance. We've gone to fracking. Well, what did fracking do? Fracking extended the timeline of peak oil for a decade or so. But what did it do? It dislocated communities. People who were in farmers sold off their land. It poisoned the watersheds, and it has this compact, measurable, disastrous consequence simply to allow the status quo to extend itself. So the vested interest in all of this is enormous. It's global. I mean, you have Saudi Arabia, you have Russia, you have all of these countries that have built, and states in the United States that are going to have terrible problems because they built their entire economy around the oil business. And it's over. So what's going to happen? Those people deserve our intelligence. All the people who have been caught up in this, in our families, in their lives, in their future, the future, their futures, and their children's futures, demands that we bring to the table an intelligent response. So I argue that this new idea, which I'm calling hydraulic society, which basically is society organized around the movement of water in all its forms, is a new paradigm. If you've got a better one, please come forward. I'm happy to join your team. But if you don't, think about this one. Because once you accept it, various things become quite clear. One is that we have the science. We have the technology right now to do this if we decide. What is missing is not this, to be longed for new innovation. What is missing is political will. And if you look at the top and you see how governments have now been essentially taken over by the interests on which the whole last century has been built, it clearly is not going to happen from the top down. It certainly, apparently, is not going to happen in this country from the top down. In Europe, in other places, in India, and some other places, in Saudi Arabia even, you begin to see people being, the top-down change. Where is it going to happen? It's going to happen, as all great revolutions do, it's going to happen from the bottom up. And there's plenty of evidence of that. There's evidence of it here in Portland, Oregon. There's evidence in the paper, in the plastic bag bans. There are millions of things that didn't come from government. They were generated by people saying, enough, enough. And the plastic bag, of course, is a perfect example. We've all know about Plastiki, this giant floating island of plastic. We probably know about microbeads. As a result of all the friction of this stuff in the ocean, it all goes down into the water column. It's ingested by fish. It's now in our bodies because we've eaten the fish as the top of the top predator. It's affecting our health. And plastic bags are everywhere. They're it's a worldwide waste. Now, ban them. That's one thing to do. Recycle them, for example. If you recycle plastic in my dump, there are 12 kinds of plastic. We recycle one. The technology exists to recycle all of it. If you recycled all the plastic that exists on Earth today, you would never have to make another new piece of plastic again. So it becomes suddenly it would become a very creative, closed loop, manageable, utilitarian thing. Who doesn't want that to happen?
Right, right. So let's talk about the hydraulic society that you envision, and just what are some of the specifics of it. I guess recycling would be one of them, but give us a kind of an overview of what that hydraulic society.
Well, there are two ways to look at it. There's an historical perspective. There were cities in civilization that were founded around water. If you look at the path of Isis in the Middle East, what's it following? It's actually following the rivers, the watersheds from the Turkish mountains down to the Arabian Sea. That's where Babylon was. That's where Nineveh was. That's where the cradle of civilization lies. And that is the trail of sustenance that exists. There were cities in India, Fata Prasikri, a Mughal city, which was completely water independent. The Aztec and Inca civilizations had this whole very sophisticated way of collecting water, using it over and over again in multiple utilities, and when they got to the point where their growth outgrew their ability to collect the water and manage it, they collapsed very suddenly. Mm-hmm. There was a book written by in the 20th century by a historian named Carl Wittvogel, and he talks about hydraulic societies and the creation of these cities. And they were built by autocracies using slave labor because they're expensive, and they require engineering. Well, we can you don't need an autocracy to do it if you understand the values and create an alternative financing system, nor do you need slaves when people understand that if they do it themselves, they're actually helping themselves. They're not being imprisoned by this work. So hydraulic society now in the 21st century could be evinced by, let's say, a building, one building. Let's just take one building, a high-rise building somewhere, call it Portland, Oregon, in which all aspects of water use are embedded in the engineering and the physical structure of the building. So it's as if you have the plumbing, let's call it, on the outside. So it collects the water. It uses the water for all the traditional sorts of hygiene. The water is available for gardens that are inside the building or on the roof of the building. The surfaces of the building, as water goes down, it generates electricity. The distribution system driven by gravity has millions of little propellers in it that generates the electricity that requires to recycle it. And you could create a building that essentially takes water that's available naturally and uses it 100%, and there is no waste. Now, that's not that difficult to do. Actually, Portland, Oregon, I think I've read this correctly, has a system now in place, and partially in your water distribution system, where you're generating electricity by essentially the friction of the water passing through the coated pipe. That's very different than what's happening in Flint, Michigan, where the water, the poison water, or the acidic water, is essentially corroding the lead pipe, and it's becoming a terrible negative as opposed to a wonderful positive. So these technologies are out there. We just need to understand them and enable them. And this gives us a context. This gives us this idea of hydraulic society, says this is an organizing principle. And it works. It can work much, much better once we make our mind to make it work. It changes how we govern each other, for example. So you have a town up here that decides it wants to build a paper plant and put all its trash and the waste in the river. They don't care about who's downstream. They don't necessarily care about the coastal resources and the fisheries and that might be affected by it. Well, if you change the paradigm, then that can't happen anymore. So the old idea of independent municipal governments fighting each other and competing with one another and damaging each other has to go away. So watershed management becomes a very important thing. Well, we have watershed associations all over the United States. We have people will blanch when I say this, the Corps of Engineers, which is a transboundary national system for essentially water management. It's supposed to take care of flood and transportation. But actually, there's a third part to the mission of the Corps of Engineers, which is environmental protection. Mm-hmm. Never hear about it, but that's part of it. Well, if all of a sudden the management of the U.S. Corps of Engineers, nationally funded, right, putting things over the top of municipal and state boundaries in order with real justification, if all of a sudden environmental protection is raised to a key, and the generation of managers who are all studying environmental sciences in the colleges all around are hired in to make these management decisions, it can all change. And it must.
Okay. I want to let people know I'm speaking, this is Political Perspectives. I'm Kathleen Stevenson, and I'm speaking with Peter Neal. Peter Neal is the founder and director of the World Ocean Observatory. His new book is The Once and Future Ocean, Notes Toward a New Hydraulic Society. If you'd like to ask a question of Peter or have him comment on something, you can give us a call at 503-231-8187. So let's just get into more ideas about this new hydraulic society. It sounds like it involves a lot of cooperation between government and technological companies. How would this all work?
Well, you can start with harmony and tranquility within society. You could start there. If government is essentially a way to enable us to live effectively together, then adopting a paradigm in which that allows for that, as opposed to one that separates us, is a good start. Okay, that's to start with. Secondly, you you have in your own home a whole series of things that you can do that would make a difference. We waste water profligately. We take showers that are endless. Our kids never they leave the water on while we brush our teeth. We wash our cars. We fill our pools. We irrigate our golf courses. We don't build into all of the production the true cost of water. So we go to the Starbucks. We go someplace. There are more coffee shops in this town, as far as I can see, than anything. And we have a cup of coffee. That cup of coffee probably is 150 gallons of water just to make that cup of coffee, from the beginning of the growth of the plant to the transportation to the cup it's served in and all the rest of it. You know, it's over $1 million to make a Volkswagen. I mean, 1 million gallons to make a Volkswagen. So, and that's not, where's that? If when I walk down the aisle in the supermarket, I hear nothing but wasted water. I see it in the packaging, and I see it in the processing of all these foods that we eat. And I say to myself, these are all decisions that we can make that drive market conditions. So I'm not going to buy these things. I'm not going to, and I'm not going to use them, because that is a way that I can contribute. Well, you say, well, if I turn off the water, does it really make a difference? Well, if you're 7 billion people, and you do, it makes a difference. If you have a water system in your town that allows for the town to flourish, people will move there. People will live there. People will look for the amenities. The real estate values will. There will be jobs created. There'll be all this stuff that are part and parcel of living together and surviving. But if you don't do those things, we see the evidence of the consequences, which is terminal. This is the thing. People keep saying to me, well, Peter, you're a little shrill about this. And I've thought about this. I mean, you know, am I losing effectiveness by being so emotional about it and so definitive? And my argument is, well, I'm an advocate. Advocates do that. That's what advocates are supposed to do. They're supposed to get out, use their voice, and persuade people with as much energy and articulation and imagination as you can to change behaviors. That's what we do. But we can advocate for too much chocolate, too. We can advocate for all kinds of things. But if we don't advocate for a system that provides us this essential element, then we essentially are committing suicide. Mm. We don't need oil. We don't need diamonds. We don't need uranium. But we do need water.
Again, we're speaking with Peter Neal, and we are going to start taking calls at 503-231-8187, and Harvey is on the line. Harvey, your question or comment.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you very much for the show. And Peter, you're one of my heroes. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And first of all...
Well, you're one of my heroes, too. If you think that way about me, I think that way about you.
Yes. Well, I raise a glass of water to you. Well, the first thing is that, you know, the fossil fuel industry is coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear is second only to agriculture in the daily uses of our freshwater resources. And, of course, you know, to the mining, refining, the fracking. I mean, it's unbelievable how much water they use. And and we have to move to non-water generation of electricity. And it turns out that once manufactured and installed, solar panels use no water over their 20 to 25-year warranty. But there's also thermoelectric, that's heat to electricity, piezoelectric, that's pressure to electricity. There's many, many forms of electricity now that can be generated without the use of water. And so that's, we have to move to the non-use of water generation of electricity, and that's a big one. Like the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant in California uses 2.5 billion gallons of water a day to cool the reactors. We're really caught up in this. And one thing that a technology that that exists is called thermoelectric, the thermoelectric generation of water out of the atmosphere. You know, over time, our atmosphere is just getting more and more saturated with water. With the global warming, it's melting off the ocean surfaces. And so that's one of our biggest problems because it turns out that water in the atmosphere is a greenhouse gas. And so we have to essentially plug into the atmosphere to get our water now. And thermoelectric devices, you can go to Google and put in thermoelectric water generators, and there's these companies that pull water out of the air. They filter it, and it's drinkable, and that's one way to go. But again, it's the fossil fuel industry is the big nut to crack, and we got to move right beyond them to the non-use of water, the use of the generation of electricity that doesn't use water.
Well, all good points, absolutely. I don't want to dismiss hydro, by the way, right off the bat. You know, hydro does work in many, many ways, and it can work in ways that are sensitive to the environment and generate small scale hydro, for example, is actually in my state is coming back. It was a state that had many, many bad dams and they fall apart and they were abandoned and all the rest of it. And they certainly interfered in the cycle of alewives and things like that were going back to their spawning areas and all the rest. But there are ways now to do some hydroelectric projects that I don't think we should just throw that away. There are already people harvesting water from the atmosphere. There, you know, in India and places like that, they have these big nets, and they just, as the fog moves through, it condenses on these nets, and the water comes into a system, goes right into the irrigation situation. Industrial agriculture needs to be talked about a lot because it's an enormous water consumer, and what happens is it gets mixed with nitrates with the use of fertilizers, and so it goes into the watersheds, it goes into the rivers, and so when you come to the end of the Mississippi River, for example, you have this enormous area of eutrophied water where there nothing can live. There is no oxygen in the water whatsoever. So industrial agriculture, as we have known it, and in terms of the projects that we products that we consume, we need to think about those things. And, you know, there's the famous story of the almond farm. Well, the almond farm is all this water that's used for a very, you know, a product that we it's a good product, tastes good, we'd like to use them, but it's not necessary for us to use it and subsidize it. The other thing to say is water is not just fresh water. Only 3% of the water on Earth is fresh, and 2% of the two-thirds of it is locked in the poles. So what in the North and the South Poles. So what we have is 7.5 billion people living on 1% of the water on Earth. So we need to think about the ocean, which is the other 97%, right, of what it represents. And so freshwater sustainability is one aspect of that. And we will inevitably desalinate water. There's just no question. Saudi Arabia now is almost 100% desalinated water. Australia is dealing with its drought conditions with desalinated water. There are problems with it. There are technological problems. There's corrosion. There's some environmental questions that are raised. These are not questions that will necessarily go unsolved, and they are being solved in ways that are allowing for people. There's a big new San Diego desal plant that's come online in a repurposed traditional energy plant. So desalinated fresh water is a key part of it. But think also about the ocean as this enormous other center of global productivity, in the best sense of it. So we will turn to the ocean for food. 40% of the protein on Earth is now, it comes from the sea. We are unconscionably depleting that just the same way we were doing it with oil. There are laws, there are treaties, there are agreements, there is little enforcement. And so what you have is the ability to essentially redress that through international agreements and understanding of the problem. I have this theory. There's a wonderful journalist named Ian Arena. We're doing a series on the New York Times about illegal fishing. And my theory, I don't have the forensic abilities, but my theory is that the world supply of illegal fish, non-sustainable fisheries, is controlled by about 20 people on Earth. They're in Taiwan. They're in Ecuador. They're in Holland, there are these companies that behind companies and management contracts and offshore entities and all the rest of it own the ships that are flagged and renamed and all the rest of it. And they're the ones that are accountable for most of the overfishing and the illegal fishing. That's a political problem. That's an enforcement question. But we need to understand that the ocean is producing food for us in ways that are going to have to be further investigated and maximized and managed in a productive, efficient, and sustainable way. Another one is the coral reefs. Let's do mangroves first. We've destroyed the mangroves around the world. Mangroves were the best and the greatest incubators of young fish, and they were the thing that mitigated storm damages and sea level rises. Mangrove swamps essentially protected us from surge. So we ripped them all out, built hotels on them, filled them in, changed the whole hydraulic pattern of the area, and now we wonder about, well, why? So now people are out there essentially replanting mangroves. Well, that's, if we're reforesting in the Amazon, why not re-mangrove in the coastal areas? I mean, these are things that could be done, and there's work to be done. There's profits to be made.
But that's kind of what scares me, is the profits to be made. It's like, how do you accomplish this in our capitalistic society, which tends to turn to exploitation?
Well, that's, am I with you on that? Step by step. I'm an older guy, so I'm not totally anti-capitalist. I don't think that I think it's the practice. I think it's like having a tool. I mean, you can have a tool and you can use it to save lives, and you can use it to kill people. That my problem is the people who are indifferent to the negatives of what they do, and the hypocrisies that are in that, and the system that is allowing them to perpetuate their values. We're surrounded by it, and I'm on the barricades with you step by step. That doesn't mean, however, that we can't create something that actually is profitable. I ran a not-for-profit for 30 years, and the reason it survived, because it had none of the traditional support systems of subsidies and endowments, it survived as a museum of all things, the most sort of inefficient thing on earth. But it became 80% revenue driven by virtue of a philosophical change and a behavioral change in how a museum operates. And so it essentially became almost self-sustaining. And I actually had a plan to make it 100% self-sustaining, which involved the World Ocean Observatory, actually. But the point was that the banker who became the chairman of that couldn't wrap his mind around it. And, bankers cut their way to success. Entrepreneurs earn their way to success. So I'm a cultural entrepreneur. So I argue that you can essentially use that energy and imagination in the name of good. It doesn't all have to be evil. So let's say that. Secondly, if you look at, let's go beyond mangroves. Let's go back to, say, coral reefs. Okay, coral reefs, oh my gosh, they're beautiful. We've acidified the ocean. Acidification is a huge problem. It doesn't get talked about that much. We talk infinitely more about plastic when the acid and the pH changes in the ocean. It's far, far more difficult to deal with and much harder to solve over time. So what happens? The coral reefs are all bleaching out, and everybody's upset about that, rightfully so. And you can see it in the Great Barrier Reef. You can see it in lots of places. And usually it's the context of tourism. Oh my gosh, it's going to destroy the dive industry, or it's going to serve the tourist hotels, or all that sort of thing. Well, that's true. But more importantly, that is the incubator. Those coral reefs are the pharmacopoeia, where there are literally hundreds of thousands of species that have not even yet been identified. And in that one place that has not been poisoned by fertilizers and not been essentially exhausted by all the microbe exploitation of microbes on land, you have the potential for, right now, in cancer demonstration studies, about half of them are derived from marine organisms, the cures for cancer. Well, in that pharmacopoeia, in the coral reef, lies the answer to all of these questions about future health problems. Mm. And then there's security. There's all this issue of instability and disruption of patterns as a result of that, and how the ocean may essentially, people are migrating to the ocean by the thousands. The heartlands are dying and the coastal areas are developing. And how are we going to plan around that? And how are we going to do that in a way that understands the problem and solves it in advance? How are we going to deal with the very fact that the ocean provides us empathy? It provides us solace. People go to the water to be alone, to think, to understand themselves, to worship. These are all aspects of water and ocean that matter. And when you add all these things up, climate, fresh water, food, energy, health, security, community, psychological realization, and solace, why would you not do this? Why would you not say, Peter, this is amazing. Where can I buy the book? Let's buy the book. But more importantly, much more importantly, because, you know, my wife asks me, well, what are you doing? What do you care about? Do you care about selling the book? Not really. I care about the idea. I would rather come to KBOO and talk to people in KBOO. If none of you buy the book, that's fine. If somehow by talking with you and getting this idea across, if that happens, the value is beyond my imagination, mm-hmm. and even my ego.
I'm speaking with Peter Neal. This is Political Perspectives, and we are still taking calls. We have less than 20 minutes left in the interview, so please call now if you would like to pose a question to Peter. The number to call is 503-231-8187. And one of the issues that you have touched on, Peter, is political will. Mm. How does that play into this? How can that happen with what you're talking about?
Well, we talk about this now in this election climate all the time. What's happening with political will? I fall back on the essential verities. Democracy is a better way of behaving than autocracy or oligarchy, or dictatorship. Or fascism, or any of these other things that we know don't work. And so I get very frustrated and very angry when I hear anyone say they're not going to vote. I don't care whether you're a millennial or you're a retiree. You have the moral responsibility in this system to speak your mind. It is your greatest single freedom. And when I hear people saying, oh, well, I don't, you know, if Bernie doesn't win or if somebody else doesn't win, I'm going to sit it out, it makes me furious. What gives them the right not to vote? They're riding on the backs of the rest of us who do. And that sense of entitlement is, to me, outrageous. It's morally reprehensible. So don't get me started on anyone who says, I'm going to sit this out because my guy didn't win. I don't believe that. Life is nothing but compromise. Let's face it, we all compromise all the time, every minute of our lives, one way or another. And we do it intelligently, and we do it with moral value, and we do it with this, and we do it with that. But if we don't do it, we're sidelined and we're hopeless.
So how does the political process play into your ideas about this, or about how to work towards this?
Well, I go back to the bottom up. I go back to populist actions in local communities. I think that, for example, you can manage water in your church. You can advocate for water management with your employer. You can do it in your own home. These are all political acts. These are political acts, and you can do it with skill and sympathy and all the rest of it. And you'll lose sometimes, and you'll win in other times. And it's that kind of engagement that's going to happen. You know, revolution only comes from the bottom. Change is only driven from the people who understand that it must occur. And the vested interests are basically either totally contracted by the status quo, or they're fearful. We have those two things. We have vested interests going, and we have fear of change. Those two forces, political forces, are I believe, could destroy our country, could destroy a lot of things, because though that kind of complacency is antithetical to essentially building your own future. So whether it's your own career, or whether it's your own family, or whether it's your own community, whether it's your own nation, you need to do that and take part. And there's plenty of work to do. There's not a soul on earth who couldn't engage this and find meaningful, make a meaningful contribution to doing it.
You're listening to Peter Neal. He is the author of The Once and Future Ocean, Notes Toward a New Hydraulic Society. He will be speaking at the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference in Eugene tomorrow night as the opening keynote address. And we're taking calls for 15 more minutes at 503-231-8187. We have Jeremy on the phone. Jeremy, your question or comment?
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
Peter, do you think you could team up with Bernie Sanders and go on tour and just, you know, you two can just have at it and educate the rest of the people that are in the dark?
I love the guy. And social democracy is something that, you know, let's forget the labels for a minute. I mean,
right.
Social democracy, when you take it apart and actually look at what happens in a social democracy and how that process works, you know, there's a whole aspect of it that it already exists. I mean, we live in a social democracy already, and the question is the functionalities of it and the impact around the people nibbling at away at it around the edges. I'll give you a perfect example. I kept looking for the legal structure. Kathleen asked the question about what do we do in this world. I kept looking for the legal structure, and I'm not a lawyer, but there is this thing which is founded in Roman law and came through English common law called Our Nature's Trust, Nature's Trust, and it's a doctrine which essentially is built into the U.S. Constitution in a way that says that natural resources are owned by the people and they can be licensed and exploited by others, but only to the extent that they remain sustainable for future generations. And that is the law on which was based in the 1970s, the Environmental Protection Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. All of those things were essentially tested in the Supreme Court and upheld using the Nature's Trust doctrine. Now that, when I found that in this book written by a professor, Mary Woods, at the University of Oregon, I said to myself, there it is. That's the answer to the legal foundation on which we can bring the cases. And right here in Portland, Oregon, there is this organization called the Children's Trust. And the Children's Trust is bringing cases against state laws, and now one case federal law, based on the public trust doctrine, Nature Trust, and all of the plaintiffs are under 18 years of age. So you have the youth, the people who are the inheritors of this myth. I don't want to call them the beneficiaries, because we're not leaving them a very, very powerful legacy. But they are able, using these doctrines, using these organizations, using these kinds of initiatives, all of which we can contribute to in many different ways, to take back the things that have been diluted by little amendments, little subsidies, little changes in the tax code, little bits and pieces like fish nibbling around the edge of on the coral reef, feeding off the thing and slowly getting fatter while the thing they're eating on dies. And that's what's been going on. And we know about lobbyists and we know about all this stuff, but when you start to really understand how that works and how it's been going on for 40 years, 50 years, they have been
utilize the 800-year-old document in addition to this called the Magna Carta.
How about the Magna Carta? We'll start. I'll go with you on that. I'm in on that.
Peter, you're wonderful. You're wonderful. I want to make two quick points.
Yeah.
The oceans are so important. If you know, you're aware of the term. You said you're an older guy, the salt of the earth. That person's the salt of the earth. The oceans are the salt of the earth. And if the oceans die, we're done.
Right.
We're done. And they do have medical cures. The sea coral is so important, and I could share things with you for hours. Please stay as long as you can, and I'll try to make it to your forum tomorrow night.
Thank you. That would be great. I think either you or the other the previous caller mentioned was talking about electricity and energy. You know, the ocean is the biggest geothermal heat pump ever. I mean, other than the sun, we won't go there. But the fact is that you have in the sun and in the ocean this amazing ability, and the technology already exists, subverted by the oil companies, of course. But the fact is that that technology exists, and there are now geothermal plants that are beginning to come online that also they have some problems, but you can fix those problems. But you're sitting here. I mean, people didn't have heat pumps in their homes a decade ago. Now heat pumps are pervasive, and they are making a contribution. Well, that geothermal concept is sitting there in worldwide. So we have engineering. We have the ability to build these kinds of things. If we can build floating oil rigs in the Arctic and allow our company to waste $9 billion of shareholder value and have the CEO still have his job is appalling to me. But that same $9 billion invested by that same company, Royal Shell, if they actually had taken that money and thought, well, why don't we do a demonstration geothermal project? And by the way, we have indigenous communities in the Arctic that need heat.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have Todd on the phone. Todd, your question or comment, please, for Peter Neal.
Hi, yeah, my name's Todd. I'm a KBOO volunteer, and I'm also a graduate of the University of Oregon School of Law and also with their environmental program. And just a couple quick comments. You know, interestingly, if we sort of rewind tape here and go back, you know, if Al Gore had been elected president, you know, if Scalia had died prior to that, you know, he would have been elected. What would he have done to have shifted the paradigm? He, you know, at least through his Inconvenient Truth stuff, and where is he now? But when we need him still, but he at least posited the notion that there's an economic good to be had from this energy paradigm shift, and you suggested that still can happen. A couple quick terms here that are being misused. You know, we've got Bernie Sanders out there, and I hope he hangs on with Hillary, you know, because he needs to kind of keep beating the drum, at least for the propositions he puts out there. He hasn't properly defined socialism, though, or told everybody, hey, we're already using socialism. Look at your fire department. Look at your police department. You know, both state, county, and federal. Those are all examples of socialism, as is the military. You know, combining all of that money together for that, you know, in place of a private company. That is socialism. He needs to remind the so-called conservatives that's what's happening. Secondly, the term conservative, you know, a conservative, it means to conserve. It should mean to conserve your H2O, as you posit there, and conserve your energy. But no, they just view it as conserving their money or, you know, minimizing taxes. But a true conservative would actually buy insurance for things as they do for their home and their car. So a true conservative would take the notion that, gosh, what if climate change is truly happening? I need insurance on that. I need to back the team that is, you know, protecting the environment. And that's one thing I need to put out to we who believe in climate change, that the term habitability has not been properly posited out there, that the issue is it's not whether the world's going to keep spinning and be around. It'll be around until, you know, the sun implodes or, you know, we hit by some huge asteroid. The issue is habitability for people. You know, we, the soft-tissued human beings, as well as all of our animal friends and all of that, you know, whether we'll be around in 100 or 2 years. And so it's just amazing that so-called conservatives have been co-opted. You know, there's agency capture and all of that other good stuff or bad stuff. But they, you know, people who don't even own oil stocks are having, you know, money in the game, have been bought out by this so-called conservative concept of, you know, turning a blind eye to the science that's out there, staring them in the face, saying, oh, well, I want to, you know, continue to use my fossil fuels, and, you know, as if there's no tomorrow. And gosh, look, it's under $2 a gallon. And so that I think is just some fakery that's going on, some misdirection. And it's rather scary.
There's this old thing called Pascal's wager about the belief in God. And you can say, well, you know, I believe in God. Fine. Or you can say, well, I really don't believe in God, but maybe I ought to hedge my bets, because if I don't and he's real or she's real, I don't want to get left out. And I use Pascal's wager with climate deniers. I say, well, what if you're wrong? Don't tell me the scientists are wrong. What if they're right? Ask that question. And then what have you done? What have you done then to deliberately, essentially, obfuscate and destroy? So just doing a kind of actuarial analysis of the situation, you would want to do something other than legislate that you can't even use the word in a bill or a text. So there's that. And the other thing is, socialism is a weird... I prefer social democracy, actually. There's a book called Ecology and Socialism. I've read it. It's a very good book. Very good about Marx and Engels. They were environmentalists. They wrote well about these sort of things. But the socialists that we know, socialist governments, for the most part, have not done a very good job with environmental management. Certainly, the USSR didn't do a good job. So the idea of taking sort of social institutions that are run by governmental institutions and adding to it a balanced democracy, the democratic participation, that to me is something that we could talk about. And none of these candidates, by the way, are talking about this with any intelligence whatsoever. Bernie, Hillary, none of the others are actually dealing with the climate way in any intelligent way whatsoever. And I guess they find it politically untenable or not so important, but it is the crisis of our time. And you're right, someone mentioned military. The most active program in the U.S. government now about climate change is the U.S. Navy, because they get it. They understand the security implications of sea level rise and all the rest of it. You're looking at the China Sea, and we're acting out right now a kind of geopolitical drama that's based on control, not just of ocean territory, but of fisheries. I can go on and on. We're running out of time.
We are. I'm sorry to say, Peter, that we are running out of time. So we just have a minute or so left. I want to tell people it's Peter Neal we've been talking about. He's the founder and director of the World Ocean Observatory and the author of the new book, The Once and Future Ocean, Notes Toward a New Hydraulic Society. He will be at the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference tomorrow night, Thursday night, giving the opening keynote address. And any like 30 seconds or to a minute that you'd like to say at the end of Political Perspectives here, Peter?
The message I argue is that the sea connects all things. And connection is what we need more than anything else in this world. We have the tools for connection like we've never had them before. The question is, how do we reach out, who we reach out to, and how inclusive we can become. And the one thing about the ocean is it includes everything.
Great. Final words. And Casey, thanks for being here. I can see that in the family, you maybe didn't get in as many words as I don't know.
Can you imagine what it was like growing up?
I've spent a lot of time on KBOO mics in my time, okay. And this is the first time he's been here. So.
No, it's great to have you both.
Thank you for community radio. That's how a lot of this got started, with WERU in Blue Hill, Maine, a community radio station. And if it wasn't for community radio, all of this kind of messaging would not actually find an audience. And so...
Right. And a website, real quick?
WorldOceanObservatory.org.
Right. And you can see World Oceans Radio there.
You can download it on iTunes and subscribe and spread the word. And you can download the book on Amazon or order it from your private independent bookseller. And you can review it. And let's turn it into a movement.
Okay, Peter Neal, Casey Neal, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thanks, Kate, Kathleen, for engineering, and stay tuned for Air Cascadia on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Mayoral Candidate Forum on Social Justice, March 10th at 6:30 p.m. at Maranatha Church in Portland. The forum will be a public conversation with leading mayoral candidates about social justice issues in our community. The program will be moderated by Israel Bayer of Street Roots, Joanne Hardesty of the NAACP Portland branch, and Jason Renault of the Mental Health Association of Portland. Again, that's the Mayoral Candidate Forum on Social Justice, Thursday, March 10th at 6:30 p.m. at Maranatha Church, 4222 Northeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Yes, it is 10 a.m. and you do have it tuned to KBOO Portland. And coming right up is Chris Andre with Air Cascadia. That is followed at 10:30 by Flashpoints. Today on Flashpoints, more excerpts from the documentary film Capitalism. And then at 11, it is The Bike Show with guests Kimball Taylor and Lorenz Finneson, who explore how bicycles carve their mark from Tijuana immigrants to Boston movers and shakers. So you're going to want to stay tuned for that. Here we come, Air Cascadia.